Do you know a veterinary professional who goes above and beyond? Whether it's a veterinarian, technician, practice manager, or rising star, now's the time to recognize their impact. Nominations for the 5th Annual Veterinary Heroes Awards are open through April 30th. Help celebrate the individuals making a difference in veterinary medicine. Submit your nomination today at dvm360.com. Let's honor the heroes among us.
Hello and welcome to the Vet Blast podcast. I am your host, Dr. Adam Christman, Chief Veterinary Officer here at Fetch DVM 360.
Hey, how well can you diagnose a dog that has torn their cranial cruciate ligament? Well, we're going to review some of the basics of it, surgical approaches, and we're going to chat with our wonderful colleague and friend that's joining us, Dr. Carl Maritato's in the house. How's it going, Doc?
It's great. I'm wonderful. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being on the show. And to the listeners, Dr. Maritato is DVM360's Veterinary Hero of the Year for 2024 for surgery. So congratulations, by the way.
Thank you. Thank you. That was a great honor. And it was a lot of fun to go to the Long Beach conference and experience it all.
It was so nice. It was great meeting your wife and your adorable fur baby. And, you know, what did that mean to you, by the way, that you got nominated and elected by your peers?
Yeah, no, it was great. It made me feel that everything I do every single day, which to me feels like a lot. that it's being appreciated. I do it for the animals, number one, but then of course I do it for their owners and my community, number two. And the animals let me know by kissing me, except for one bit me in the lip the other day for the first time in 28 years. So,
oh no. Unappreciated.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. It was really special. We had a great time, and the award sits right on my desk.
Good.
Yeah.
Well deserved. And by the way, we are still accepting nominations, everyone. So please nominate away for any colleague that has done that you can think of as done great work, whether it be a surgeon, general practitioner, technician, CSR. We have over 13 categories. So we'd love to see those nominations coming in. We have over 100 of them so far. So and you now have the lovely privilege of going through them.
That's right. That's right. I'm just about done picking my nominations as well.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Great. Mm-hmm. So Dr. Maritato is a board certified veterinary surgeon at MedVet Cincinnati, where he's been a part of the medical team since 2010. And he attended University of Florida. Go
Gators.
You know it.
Right. They're in the old March Madness. They're basketball.
Yeah, they are. That's right.
Yeah.
And at Ross University School of Veterinary Medicine, he earned his DVM degree, graduating with great honors. And following graduation, he completed a year-long internship with a surgery residency at Louisiana Veterinary Referral Center, now MedVet Mandeville. And he completed more work at MedVet Columbus. And that's where he practices great work in minimally invasive arthroscopic procedures, as well as he first performed the first cementless canine total hip replacement. What was that like?
Yeah, it was fun. I mean, it was the first time that that surgery had ever been done in Cincinnati. That was 15 years ago. So it was an experience. It was great. You know, total hips are, they're a different surgery altogether. They require a lot. And actually, believe it or not, over the years, I don't see so many dogs in my city of people that elect to have total hips. So we don't do them very often. And at this point, because I didn't do so many of them, I decided that ethically, I didn't feel good doing them because I wasn't doing them. Not like, ACLs. Yesterday, I did 9, right? So it's a little different.
You did 9 ACLs yesterday?
Yeah, I do about 50 a month. So when you're doing that, you're good at it. But when you're only doing 3 or 4 of something a year, you're not good at it. And so I didn't feel ethically good doing that. So now if I get a client who wants total hip replacement, I send them to my old mentor at MedVet Columbus, Dr. Barnhart, and he does them for me. And then I do their rechecks in Cincinnati. And I feel good about that. Because I want to be good at what I do, but if you don't get enough cases to be good at it, then you're not helping anyone by not being good at it. Yeah.
Yeah, excellent. Okay, so we have a dog that's presenting to us that's toe touching, pelvic limb, either left or right, and sometimes you can smell them coming in. You hear the history, and you see that dog that's coming in. It could be even the small dogs too. They're just not non-weight bearing. Where do you begin in terms of physical exam on your approach when you're thinking, oh, this one might have torn their CCL?
Yeah. Well, the first thing I do is try to not think that. I try to be unbiased, and I do the same exact physical exam every single time that I do it. When it's the hind limb, I always start in the toes, and I start just pushing and moving every digit through range of motion. And I'll be honest with you, if I do think the ACL is the problem, I'll actually kind of skip over that joint because I don't want to run out of doggy minutes before they get upset with me. So I'll guide my hands up and down their legs. I just try to feel for symmetry. I try to feel for muscle atrophy. The biggest thing that I'm feeling for, if I'm feeling for an ACL just by when I'm rubbing my hands on their legs, is I'm feeling for a medial buttress and comparing the two sides. The biggest trick, I think, or thing that tricks most of the veterinarians is the partial tears. And especially when they're somewhat early, I certainly get a lot of texts, hey, I'm going to send you a dog. I'm not getting any drawer. So I don't know if it's an ACL. And then when I feel it, I know immediately it is an ACL because you can feel that medial buttress just really sticking out compared to the other side. So start at the toes, work my way up, just feeling muscle mass, manipulate the ankle, make sure that's all good. Another thing that can trick people in when they think it's an ACL, particularly if it's an Australian Shepherd or a breed like that, is luxation of the superficial digital flexor tendon. So I always try to feel the ankle for to make sure that there's no popping going on down on the caudal aspect of that calcaneus. And then I run my hands up, and then that's where I start to feel for buttresses as well as for muscle atrophy in general, and then work my way up to the thigh. Then I extend and manipulate, extend and abduct their hips. And then I always try to remind people the forgotten cause of lameness in dogs is sciatica, particularly large, older breeds. So I'm always palpating the lumbosacral area and looking for nerve root signatures. Elevating their tail, that's a big thing where they'll get nerve root signatures if they have sciatica. And then when I say, for example, let's say I went up the leg and I definitely noticed there was buttress, and I'm like, okay, now we're going to go to the knee where we suspect our problem is. And to be honest with you, I don't do drawer in dogs. People, I do it when they're knocked out, but I see appointments every 30 minutes, and I know that people don't want to spend all day here, and I don't want to sedate dogs all day long looking for drawer. And there's, in my opinion, thrust is non-agitating to the dog. So I check for craniotibial thrust on every single dog. And actually, I have a video that I'm actually editing. I'm not as good as you at the social media thing, so my old man brain is working on that. But I have a great example of how the dog just stands there and couldn't care less what I'm doing to it. Whereas you try to grab the dog's knee and you're holding it hard and you're squeezing its tibia and you're trying to do drawer and they're fighting with you and they don't like it because it hurts. But thrust doesn't really hurt because it's the same as when they're walking. And so it's not, they're kind of used to it already. So the way that I check for thrust to try to explain without a visual is, let's say it is the left leg. Okay. I put my right wrist, my right arm between their legs actually, and I support them. I put my arm under between their legs under their pubis. And I put my right hand on the front of the knee. I put my index finger on their kneecap and I put my ring finger on their tuberosity. Then I take my left hand, since it's the left leg, and I just grab their foot, and that's when I just start to move the ankle. And I always put the leg in partial flexion because, again, that's why people miss partial tears. If the leg is in full extension and they have a partial tear, you're not going to get drawer because of the difference between the craniomedial band and the caudolateral band of the ACL. So I always put them in some degree of flexion. And then you simply move their ankle back and forth to mimic walking, and you will feel that craniotibial thrust. And it works every time. So that is definitely something that I encourage people to try to get good at. I teach, you know, the vets in my city, when I do CEs for them and things, to honestly just not fight with the dogs looking for drawer. That thrust is just so much nicer for them, and it's accurate.
Right. No, that's helpful. Sometimes I find that when you have both medial patella luxation, sometimes that can mask a little bit of what we're finding, right? Do you find that too, that can happen?
Yeah, so it definitely can trick people to thinking that they have an ACL tear when they don't, because it's kind of overly internally rotating them. And, or it's the opposite. One of the common things I get is I'll get, say, a 9-year-old Westie sent to me for patella luxation. And, you know, we automatically know, okay, it's 9 years old, it's had a patella luxation its whole life. If it just started limping last week, it tore its ACL. Then the patella was just there for the ride. And of course, I used Westie as the example because Westies are the most common small breed of dog to tear their ACLs. So.
Well, I got to add Clark W. Griswold to the list because I got to show you a video of that little guy, not my little 9-pounder, because right now he's not bearing weight on his left hind leg. I go, what the hell is this? You know, I was like, no, you get one pass with IBDD. That's it. You know,
that's it. So, and he's a dachshund, right?
Yeah, he's the mini wire hair.
You know, I started my residency in 07. So, I mean, I guess you could say I've been doing surgery for just about 20 years. I've never cut a dachshund for an ACL tear. Now, my colleague recently, I think, had one, and I couldn't believe it, but it is just not common in that breed. And so whenever anybody says to me, I have a dachshund with an ACL tear, I always go, I think we need to really check that dog and see what's going on there.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
You hear that, Clark? Okay. What are your thoughts too? I hear this back and forth from the generalists is that they like to sedate the animals a lot because, to your point, maybe it's difficult. We were just talking about cranial drawer. Maybe, you know, you were talking about tibial thrust. Is it ideal to get, you know, radiographs and, you know, having them sedated? Like, sedated exams, of course, are great, but sometimes in an ideal world from cost perspective, it could be a little bit challenging. But what are your thoughts on that?
I think it depends on what is going to occur with that patient. Is this patient in a general practice setting where it's going to have the surgery there, or is it going to be referred out? And the reason I say that is because if you're going to send it to me, don't spend the money on the x-rays over there. I don't need them because I need them to be exactly positioned the way that I need them to do my measurements for my TPLO, right? But if you're going to do them the surgery is going to be done there and you are still working towards your diagnosis, then yes, I think that radiographs of the stifle are very helpful. Obviously, you're not diagnosing the tear, you're diagnosing the things that come along with the tear. So you're looking for joint effusion, you're looking for displacement of the fat pad, you're looking for any of the arthritic changes that they start to get. And honestly, that's one of my biggest sticking points. Dogs don't just get arthritis. Something is wrong with the joint that we have to fix. If you see arthritis in the joint of a knee, please don't just say, yep, your dog has arthritis in the knee and start it on glucosamine. No, it has arthritis in the knee because it has an ACL tear. Even if you can't feel the instability, that's what's causing that until proven otherwise.
Oh, I love that. That's a strong, powerful, but yeah, you're right. You're definitely, I mean, I could think of cases too. I've done it. I've definitely fell into that. And I was like, oh, there's arthritic changes that are in your, you know, older Labrador retriever in the knee.
Yeah.
And yeah, you know, I think look back and I was like, yeah, probably an ACL tear. Okay. So let's talk about some of the surgical options that are out there. And I know you just mentioned TPLO. What are some indications for different sizes of dogs for surgery?
Sure. Obviously, it's a big kind of, one could argue, controversial topic. Yeah. But I guess I would say that, again, it kind of falls down on perspective and who's doing it. I mean, for me, for example, my dog, Molly, she weighs 11 pounds. I have a TPLO plate that will fit her leg because I've made sure that companies I work with make plates that small.
Yeah, yes.
And it's purely because, you know, by all available metrics, that have been measured so far, it's superior. You know, there's no doubt about that. But I'm also a very realistic person. I mean, I just came back from Barbados teaching an old friend of mine and all his friends, his colleagues there that work there, how to do surgeries. And I understand that, you know, we don't always have the ivory tower situation, right? And so I think that, you know, lateral suture is a very good surgery. It's a good functional surgery, particularly for animals that, you know, in my opinion, are maybe 40 pounds and less. I certainly know that it's done every day in animals that are bigger. I think that you really start to get into tricky territory the bigger they get. I would say on average, 3 to 4 times a month, three or four of my TPLOs out of the 50 that I do a month are dogs that are larger that I'm redoing because the lateral suture didn't hold in larger breed dog. So, you know, I get cost differences for sure. I respect that. And I would say that I just try to encourage everyone that if you have a client that, you know, has the ability to either now or save for a little bit and get what I would say is the, you know, gold standard surgery, let's put it that way, then I would aim for that. But for when we can't, I think a well-done lateral suture can do very, very, very well. The key to that is it has to be well done. A lot of the issues that I see, particularly, you know, if somebody sends me an x-ray and says this, you know, this dog had a lateral suture and it's not doing well, many times I can look at the x-ray and I know automatically why it's not doing well. And it's either A, it had a lateral suture in an animal with a massive slope. A dog that has a huge tibial plateau angle is just not going to do well with lateral suture. And that's, you know, one of my good buddies in the city here, he texted me one day and said, hey, I notice I'm struggling with Westies when I do a lateral suture. And I said, that's because it's Westies. Westies have huge slopes. I mean, they're always, you know, 30, 35, sometimes even 40 degrees. Sometimes I even have to do a CBLO instead of a TPLO because they're so steep. And that's really going to have a hard time with a lateral suture, because just think of the biomechanics, right? The steeper the slope, the harder the force is on that tibia that's just thrusting the bone forward. So those are things that people really want to look at and say they're going to think about doing a lateral suture, and then they take a radiograph of the joint. If you look at that and you go, oh my Lord, that is a huge slope, you might want to really think about putting a lateral suture in that dog. So that's one thing. The other thing that I frequently find to be a problem is if they're doing a traditional lateral suture, the hole that they put to pass the suture through the tibia is very frequently in the wrong position, you know. And if it is not in the right position, which is at that level of the insertion and the tuber of Gerty, it's basically a 90 degree angle between the insertion point and the tuber of Gerty. That's the closest you're going to get, at least on the tibia, to be in the isometric point. If you are off from that, then your suture is not going through the range of motion the way that you want it to, and it's not going to withstand the force as well, and it's most likely going to fail. And almost every single dog that I have to do a TPLO on that had a lateral suture, when I take its planning TPLO rad, I see the hole and I instantly go, there's the hole's down here, the hole's back here. It's just, it's not where it should be. So that's what I mean by, yes, a lateral suture is a very good surgery that will work in dogs of reasonable size. You know, I don't think it's reasonable to put a lateral suture in a mastiff. I just don't think that that's reasonable. You know, you're not getting 200 pound test strength and it's not going to hold. But when you're doing a lateral suture and you're doing it in a reasonable sized dog, it's just critical that you're following the techniques correctly.
Right. Yeah, that's helpful.
Yeah.
Let's talk about when price is really, really a really challenge for a lot of these pet parents out there. Mm-hmm. And they come to us and say, hey, listen, I want to do the brace. You know, I'd rather do the brace. I can't afford to do anything else other than a brace. And we know that there's several ones that are out there, but I'm just curious to get your perspective on that. you know, because I know I just saw it a few weeks ago when I was talking to a client about it. But, and in fact, actually, just before you answer that, I find it interesting that some, and I'm curious to get your thoughts on this too, that a lot of the pet parents will do their research first and want to go to the brace first versus doing the surgery. And I kind of want to talk them into the surgery because of the success rate that we see, of course, with only, yeah, you know, there's a little bit of financial, you know, obviously an investment with it, but some will just be, you know, like adamant about having the brace. But, you know, listen, when there's financial issues that happen, what are your thoughts on all this when we talk about the braces?
Yeah, it's tricky. It's tricky for two reasons. I guess the first, I'll just be honest and say it's I'm kind of spoiled because it's not the world I live in, right?
Yeah.
You know, if they've come to me, their vet's done a good job of letting them know what the reality of my world's going to be. But I do get some clients who ask me about braces and things, and I have used braces in the past, and they have been for dogs that even I don't want to do surgery on them because, you know, they have a lot of comorbidities and other sorts of things. And I think the thing that I try to tell clients is if that is the direction that they have to go, number one, I would really advise that they work with someone who understands the braces well. You know, in my hospital, I'm very spoiled. I have Sean Zimmerman. She's been a CCRP forever. She's a VTS in rehab. And, you know, I call her, she's my orthotic and prosthetic queen. You know, she does it all for me.
Yeah.
But the key is, you know, number one, working with a good brand, a brand that we know is going to hold up and is really tried to have been tested as well as we can. I think in the early days of orthotics and things, you know, the folks from the human world were just like, hey, there's a market. Let's just start making things for dogs. And it's like, yeah, it doesn't really translate that well from humans to dogs. You really got to put the time in the research. So, companies like OrthoPets and Dog Legs and those kinds of things, they've put in the time to try to figure these things out. And I think that those are, that's important. And then they need to understand that the goal of the brace is these dogs are going to have to wear this thing long, long, long term, very long term. And again, size matters in these mm-hmm. situations. And you're never going to get a Mastiff or a Dane or a big burly Shepherd or a Pitbull who's got a ham hock that's, you know, its quadriceps is bigger than its head. You know, these massive dogs, those dogs, they're not going to create enough scar tissue even in that brace to be able to eventually come out of that brace. So I think they need to be prepared that, you know, this brace is going to be something where, yeah, well, my dog's walking around the house, it doesn't necessarily, after a certain amount of time, we're probably not going to be using that every day for the next 10 years, but you might be wearing that brace when it's going for a walk. When you're going for a walk every day for the next 5, 6, however many years, you know, just like people who have to wear braces, you know, every time that they play a sport or something, if they have an injury, they always wear this thing with what they're doing. That's something they're gonna have to do. And I think the other thing I try to encourage people, you know, there's some people who will tell you, I never can or never will be able to do the surgery. Okay, I get that, that's that. Then you have those that are like, I would think about it, but it's going to take me a while, you know, from a cost perspective, it's going to take me 6 months to save, et cetera. Reality is I can't tell you how many dogs come to me every single day that, oh, my vet told me to come see you 6 months ago, but life got ahead of me. And, you know, they're still just limping with their partial tear or even with their full tear. And you take the radiograph and yeah, they've got mild to moderate arthritis, but it's amazing. You fix their leg and now they're normal again. So I think that's something also to really, I always try to put in people's minds is this isn't a broken leg. It's not if you don't do this tomorrow, the dog isn't going to be good. Obviously, the sooner the better. I put that post you probably saw. I think that you did see it. I think actually that's how this got spurred is the sooner we do it, the better for the dog. But it's not a use it or lose it right this second kind of situation. And so I try to make people not feel bad about what they can and can't do. And I also try to make them understand that if you can save for 6 months and now it's something you can do, then come back in 6 months and do the best thing you can. And then your dog will still do very, very well. I mean, when there is any degree of in loss of integrity in that joint, they're always going to feel better after you remove that problem. So,
and for follow up for surgery for post op, are you what's your recommendations? I know you mentioned rehabilitation with your technician that you have there. So rehab, laser, what are some things that you see where they can return to normal? And by the way, my other question for you, because I love having an orthopedic surgeon on, obviously, as you can tell, I just love these, because these are questions that I get asked so often. I want to make sure I'm saying the right information to these pet owners, is how often, what's the general turnaround time when they can return, quote, to normal running?
Yeah, sure. So my average TPLO dog, the post, the whole process is have surgery. At home, I want them confined for 6 weeks, and to a small area. You know, let's pick the most common dog, a Labrador. So a Labrador sized dog, I like them confined to a 6x6 area, and during that 6 weeks at home, at different intervals along that 6 weeks, we slowly increase the different things that we have them do from an exercise standpoint. We give them at home exercises that we want them to try to do. After about 2 weeks and the incision is healed, we do start doing some, 15 to 20 minute walks gently on a leash, those kinds of things. And for those who will allow us to do it and they come and see the rehab department, we get them in the Autumn Water treadmill at 2 weeks. Yes, immediately post-op, things like laser, shockwave. Shockwave enhances bone healing. So I wish I could make bone heal in 2 weeks so that people wouldn't have to do this 6 week stuff. But shockwave certainly helps enhance bone healing, so they can do that. And then they come back to me at 6 weeks, and that's when we do our recheck and make sure everything is healing the way it's supposed to. And starting that day for me, that's when they get to become a free dog in the house. After I've confirmed that they are good in that regard, now indoors, they can do stairs, they can get on furniture, they can do those things. For outdoors, I have a handout that they get that has the following 4 weeks on it. And each week they start going a lot more outside. So it's, 30, 40, 50 minute walks. And then by week 8 to 9, start doing some off leash in the backyard. And by the end of week 10, I let them be a completely free dog. And I have some amazing creatures that I've fixed, and I love the follow-up that these people give me. I mean, I've got 2 blue ribbons that sit on my desk that are thank yous of dogs that went back and won first place after doing their knees. I have a dog that works at a golf course here. Talk about living the dream.
Wow.
He works at the golf course, and his job is to chase the geese off the course. And his GPS says he runs 75 miles a day on that knee.
Oh.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So, I never guarantee someone that I can get their dog back to who they were as if this never happened to them. But I do tell them that it is absolutely my goal, and I'm going to try everything in my power. And I do feel that the vast majority of dogs that are more than just house pets. I mean, they are workers, they are sheep herders, they are what I just mentioned, blue agility, all those things, dock diving. I've certainly got the majority of them back to doing that. And that's my hope. And I would say that the average dog, I tell every client, expect a plateau of normalcy to come by around 6 months, but they're already having fun and doing whatever they want by 3 to 4 months. Yeah. They're just going to have those off and on limping days while their body's still getting used to things.
Right. Awesome.
Yeah.
Fantastic. And my last question as we wrap up is the other question pet owners is, what about the other leg? Is there, what's the statistic that was that a squeaky toy that you just sat on by the way? I just heard a squeaky toy. Maybe that was me.
No, your internet was going out. And oddly enough, because you're so used to hearing that sound when you're on a phone, I tried to move the computer as if that was going to fix something. But so that was the computer
sound. Tell me that I live with dachshunds, because that's all I hear in my head is squeaky toys. So,
I
love it. But wait, okay. So last question is about the other leg. So what about the other leg?
Yeah. So minimum 50% to, half to two thirds of dogs are going to tear the other side in their life. I certainly think that some breeds, it's much more common that we see. I mean, I honestly, in the city of Cincinnati has a wonderful rescue situation down here. So I fix more pit bulls than any other breed of dog in the city. And I tell every one of them, you'll be back in a year. Just pit bulls. And pit bulls are unique. Pit bulls and boxers, because particularly pit bulls, though, they like to tear both roughly at the same time, even before they're a year of age.
Wow.
Extremely common for me to do bilateral TPLOs because most pit bulls are less than 80 pounds. Yeah. And so I do both at one time. But yeah, it's about half to two thirds. And, you know, I always get the question, well, I want to fix this one as fast as possible because I don't want him to blow the other one out because he's bearing so much weight on it. Well, most of the studies have actually shown on force plates that most of that weight's going to the front legs, not to the contralateral leg. But even if it was, I always tell the clients, if the reason they tear the other leg is because they're bearing more weight on it, then why on earth did they tear the first one? Because they weren't walking around limping on the other leg and then therefore they tore this one. It's because it's a disease. I make them remember that this is called cruciate disease. It is a degenerative condition. 90% of ACL tears are because of this degenerative disease, of which we don't really know the reason for. You know, only 10% of ACL tears are traumatic injuries, you know, of a healthy ligament that wasn't degenerating. The rest of them, it's degenerative disease. And that's just why it happens. And so, you know, most of the studies were done in Labradors, and one study was 5.5 months. The other one was 13 months. So I just tell people, look, I've seen it. Obviously, like I said, they're both present at presentation right now, or I've seen the most frustrating ones are I've seen dogs that I have examined that dog and that other knee shows absolutely nothing wrong with it. I know 100% that there's nothing going on with that knee. And I do their TPLO, and a week later, the damn dog blows out its knee on the other side. And that's so frustrating, especially when they're less than 80 pounds, because you're like, oh, these poor people, if it would have happened a week ago, right. I could have done both at once, saved them a lot of money, a lot of headache. But so I've seen it, you know, 7 years between the first leg and the second leg. So it's just rhyme or reason. Yeah.
Well, think about in your career, this is a fantastic conversation, but you should be so proud of yourself. I mean, giving mobility to all these dogs out there. I mean, it's the number one reason why we enjoy the human-animal bond. We want to move with them. We want to enjoy them. And to see our dogs and our cats who not have that ability to move. I've been through it as a dachshund dad many times. And it's gut-wrenching. It really is. And the fact to see them, I mean, the incredible beauty of veterinary medicine is how far we've come. I mean, just from even with IVDD, with my dachshunds and seeing them walk. I mean, it depends, of course, but for mine, they walk the next day. It was just mind-blowing. Mm-hmm. And same thing with what you're doing with these dogs out there. Give them that new lease on life. So thank you for all the great work you're doing. It's amazing.
Yeah. Thank you. No, yeah, it is great. I mean, yeah, it's what I like to do the most. I mean, I like orthopedics and neurosurgery. As I told you this morning, I went in on my day off just to fix two dogs with discs in their neck just because they were hurting and nobody else could fix them. So it brings me a lot. It's what I love to do. I like to get them back to working. I don't want to see a diabetic, but I do want to make limping dogs not limp anymore.
Love it. Dr. Maritato, where can we learn more about you?
You can follow me on, I guess you call them the big three, although I don't do TikTok, but the big three, Instagram, LinkedIn, Facebook. My biggest goal is I just like to put happy stories. There's a lot of negativity in the world and I'm just trying to bring in positive. So it's really just all about success stories and happiness. And then of course the MedVet website, honestly, I'm losing count now. There's at least 44 med vets throughout the nation. So, and we only hire the best. So if you need specialty care, go to the MedVet website and see if there's a med vet near you. Yeah.
Excellent. Thank you, Dr. Maritato. Thank you for all the great work you're doing. And thank you for being on the show.
Well, thanks for having me. I'll do it anytime.
I love it. Awesome. Thank you to our listeners for tuning in. Don't forget to rate the podcast as we continue to grow. And we'll see you next time right here on the Vet Blast podcast. Take care, everybody.
Thank you for listening to the Vet Blast podcast with me, Dr. Adam Christman. Tune in next time. Remember, take care of your animals and always stay pawsome.